From the Sydney Morning Herald and The Age, this is Good Weekend Talks, and I'm Conrad Marshall. Join us as we take a deep dive into the definitive stories of the day, brought to life here and in the pages of Good Weekend magazine. In this episode, we take a look at the cultural and societal challenges faced by AFL CEO Gil McLachlan. I followed the powerful footy chief for a week in August 2019 for a cover story on how he managed everything from the Adam Goods booing saga to the rise of women's football. Today, Good Weekend editor Katrina Strickland will join me and Age senior sports writer Michael Gleeson for a chat about McLachlan's leadership, particularly going into this newly compromised season. But first, actor Nick English will read the profile in full. So tune out the world and turn your attention to Tough Call, AFL boss Gillon McLachlan on racism, sexism, and football's hotly contested issues.
It's 8 p.m, but already pitch black and freezing out on the farm, on this fertile land a couple of hours west of Melbourne, where I've come to meet Gillon McLachlan. I followed his directions. Turn off the highway near Moriac, down the Cape Otway Road, right, straight, left, through the two brick posts. And now I'm creeping along a track between the ghostly cypress windbreaks, past a big dog barking at stars, reaching the converted wool shed where McLachlan comes to escape the exciting, inspiring, exasperating, and unrelenting role he has filled for the past 5 years as chief executive of the Australian Football League. He's expecting me, but maybe doesn't hear my Hilux stop, or my footsteps circling his Birragara bolt hole, because I round a corner and have ample time to study him through the tall glass door. The 46-year-old is alone, all 197 centimetres of him, splayed on a couch by an open fire. He's poring over scattered sections of the Australian Financial Review, sipping from the neck of a Stella Artois, and the moment I knock, my wedding ring rapping too hard against double glazing, he jumps in his seat, holds his heart and swears. He's wearing faded Levi's, a blue hoodie, and a respectably muddy pair of Blundstones. The face of our national game, usually smoothed with foundation for television, is stubbly and animated. His eyes are wild hazel orbs, and when he laughs, the three lines of his forehead become six. "Hey, man," he says. "Get here all right?" He says "man" all the time. I've been following McLachlan for almost a week now, observing him at the AFL's Rising Star Awards yesterday, talking in his office the day before, and lurking at the presentation of the ceremonial All-Australian team a few nights ago at the Palais in St Kilda. As football royalty mingled in the theatre lobby, I could overhear him from a slight distance. "It's been a really good year for footy," he remarked to a commentator. "A great year." Idle patter, but also truth. Judging by the stats, the AFL is enjoying a brilliant run during McLachlan's sixth season in the top job. Memberships are at an all-time high, 1.06 million across the league this year, as is attendance at games, 6.9 million by the close of the home and away season. The average crowd, 35,108 per game, is now the fourth highest in the world, behind only America's National Football League, Germany's Bundesliga, and the English Premier League. Locally, AFL crowds are more than double those of the NRL, and more than triple those of soccer's A-League. Ticket and food prices are low, while competition between the 18 AFL clubs is high. It feels as though, on any given weekend, almost any team can win. Fans are also enjoying the sweet spot of a colossal broadcast rights deal that McLachlan negotiated in 2015 with the Seven Network, Foxtel and Telstra, worth a staggering $2.5 billion over 6 years. Oh, and the AFL Women's League he launched in 2017 has sparked a grassroots revolution, with a peak of more than 500,000 women and girls participating this year. And yet, newer teams are failing to win over crowds. A heartland state like Tasmania still has no team at all, and that AFLW competition? It's beset with issues. Not a day goes by when there isn't a new AFL folly or furphy or failure for an army of pundits to lament with grave intonation. An imperfect score review system, fans feeling change fatigue as their game is endlessly tweaked, mental health woes, concussion confusion, and those bloody umpires. Most recently, it was a pair of films about Indigenous champion Adam Goods being booed out of footy back in 2015, including the underwhelming equivocation of the AFL at the time, and, specifically, McLachlan. All this brings into sharp focus the performance of the CEO. Not so much on the staging of footy matches and the AFL's bottom line, which on any objective measure he's nailing, but on the altogether more modern metrics around the soft power component of his role. That is, his response to thorny cultural, societal and health issues, from racism and sexism to sexuality and more. There was that Wednesday morning, almost 2 years ago, for instance, where he stood under an AFL logo replaced with a prominent yes in support of marriage equality. To some, this was McLaughlin as PC thug, lecturing and bullying footy fans. To others, it was exactly the kind of leadership expected from the head of the most popular sporting code in the country. Then there was the 2017 drama in which he oversaw the resignation of two senior AFL executives, Richard Simkiss and Simon Leithlian, for inappropriate relations with younger women employed by the league. Some likened AFL House to an episode of Mad Men and noted the departures came only after the affairs became public. Others whacked McLaughlin for overreacting to relationships between consenting adults. But perhaps the most high profile of all was the booing that led Adam Goods, a former Australian of the Year, to quit the game in 2015. In recent months, as the two documentaries on that heated time were released, Ian Darling's The Final Quarter and Stan Grant's The Australian Dream, the AFL apologised, unreservedly, for not doing enough to stand with him and call it out. For many, it was too little too late. Far from being woke, the critics said, McLaughlin had shown himself to be weak, something you'd never have said of his predecessor, Andrew Demetrio, no matter what you thought of him. "I was deeply distressed," says veteran sports broadcaster and Offsiders regular Francis Leach. "It's not that it was malicious, but dodging the question of racism gave people comfort to avoid looking deeply. But also, what do you expect? Gill's never known the world not being built in his image. When would he have ever experienced being the outsider? Never in his life. That's not his fault, but his own world experience perhaps let him down in that moment." McLaughlin well remembers the maelstrom that was 2015. He listened to all parties, those disgusted by the ugly, sustained attack on a champion, and the indignant who claimed that race was not involved. His response was consequently muted and memorably stopped short of calling the hatred by name. "There's a racist undertone," he said, "but I don't believe everyone is racist." It's a stumble he now regrets. I thought to myself, am I going to say that it's racism and create a whole new spot fire? I demurred, and I can understand why I did. I just wish I hadn't, he says. I think about it a lot. My realization now is that sometimes you've just got to call it out and not nuance it and manage all these people. And I own that. Constant apologies over this have not gone unnoticed. At the All Australian Awards, whilst shadowing McLaughlin, I spoke briefly to Aboriginal MC Shelley Ware, who quietly defended him. I think Gill listens, and he has the courage to revisit his mistakes and acknowledge that he was wrong. At times, it's hard to know from where his worldview springs, whether he's the bloke's bloke of the boardroom, drawing his $1.8 million salary, or if he's still that kid who earned his pocket money shoveling horse shit on a farm in Adelaide. Is he the private school polo player, or the local footy tragic? In truth, he's all of the above. And like most leaders, he's learning as he goes along, working out to what extent he should speak up on social issues. Cultural leadership is one of the most difficult parts of the job, he concedes. We can't be the standard bearer or moral arbiter of everything, but we're community leaders, and where we take a stance, we should. Up close, McLaughlin is pragmatic and funny. Neither vanilla nor evasive, a hard thing to square with his public persona. Leach says McLaughlin reminds him of those convivial politicians who turn into Canberra robots once the cameras are rolling. He's seen barracking over the fence at local footy grounds, clomping through the mud to the huddle, and attributes the difference between his public and private personas to the vacuum-sealed walls of the AFL HQ. It's the Vatican of the Yarra, Leach says. This city-state that's a law unto itself, has cultural power, enormous political power, self-selects its cardinals from within, or, from its parishes, the clubs. It forgives its heretics if they repent, and it punishes opponents and outsiders. He's the prince of the hermit kingdom. The reigning prince is certainly that very tall person you might recognize in public. Long arms drawn nervously near his body, wearing a navy pinstripe suit of armor, like a praying mantis. But he's also the guy I meet here at the farm, beer in hand, opening the door. It's a great house, this woolshed turned weekend getaway. High ceilings with the original knotty crossbeams, a row of elevated bedrooms built into the old shearing stand. It's functional too, with hooks and shelves for riding boots and helmets. McLaughlin, his wife Laura, and their four kids come here whenever they can, which is, he says, not often enough, given the tonnage of weekend sport they watch and play. McLaughlin's happy to show me around, but uncertain why he's doing so. He's never done an extended profile interview of this sort. I don't know how I'm here, he says, seeming almost anguished. I don't really like talking about myself. That's a consequence of the way his every utterance is magnified. He jokes that if he ever wrote a book, the title would be What I Really Think, because it's very difficult to say anything in my role and not have people want to play the other side of it. If you sit where I've been for this long, you get so paranoid about how each quote can play out. So often it's a whole game of shutdown. We walk outside in the biting darkness, past a cluster of 7-foot-tall adolescent red oaks in the driveway, their roots wrapped in plastic. McLaughlin has come for one night, to do some reading, sign some contracts, but before dawn he'll be alone outside, fighting with the final bitter frost of winter to dig 15 holes and plant 15 trees in them, and maybe sneak in a ride on Twiggy or Bert. He flicks a switch in the stable. The rusty industrial lights come on slowly. Tink, tink, tink. Buzz. And there they are. A dozen or so horses in stalls, hooves in fresh hay. One of them takes a piss like a fire hose, and the steam rises up. Getting away, this is the fun stuff. See down the end? A mare and foal winning. This is one of the contradictions that emerge around McLaughlin. In the lazy description of him, the word toff comes up. Always. He did grow up on a 2,000-hectare merino and cattle property named Rosebank in Mount Pleasant, outside of Adelaide. But he was also just a farm boy. If you're not at school and it's light outside, it's time to work. If it's dark, you could come in, he says. I had a lucky upbringing. It's true that his uncle, Ian McLaughlin, is a former National Farmers Federation president, a former chairman of Australian Wool Innovation, and a defence minister in the Howard government, and that the wider McLaughlin clan is the third largest holder of private land in Australia, controlling 5.75 million hectares. That's a landmass the size of Croatia, held under the auspices of the family's Jumbuck Pastoral Company, the vast majority of which is with other branches of the family tree. His wife Laura is from a moneyed background too, being the daughter of wealthy industrialist Brian Blythe. But as noted by McLaughlin's younger brother, Seven Sport presenter Hamish, when people focus on the connections and trappings, they don't mention the days spent in the dust, drenching, shearing, mulesing sheep, marking lambs. Yes, they played polo, but only on the weekends, after we'd groomed for Dad, shot our own horses, cut our own hay for chaff, and broken our own horses in. School holidays meant being dropped off at an isolated sheep station and left with a manager for a fortnight. McLaughlin's gap year after attending St. Peter's College, an Adelaide boarding school, comprised of jackarooing in the Riverina of New South Wales. He was a bruiser, too. I once heard he'd locked Hamish's head in a cattle crush for 8 hours. It wasn't that long, Gillen clarifies, and he deserved it. His mother, Sylvia, has described the AFL boss as a serious child, always conscientious, with a quiet strength. His dad, Angus, whom his four sons called Singlet, because he was always on their backs, made uncompromising demands of his eldest boy. I realise now that those expectations were unfair, he once said. Fortunately, Gillen had the temperament to handle them. And so McLaughlin became the stereotypical firstborn. He lives in Prahran now, in Melbourne's inner east, and sees the same hierarchical treatment playing out with his own kids. Edie, 12, Cleo, 10, Sydney, 8, and Luna, 3. The way the sharpness of those edges dissipates over time, he says. The second child different from the first, the third from the second, until the last is almost brought up by the other kids. He studied commerce at Adelaide University, then law at the University of Melbourne, living in at Trinity College. He played more than 200 games for Melbourne's Uni Blues, a top team in the amateur league, but was not good enough to play professionally, sitting on Carlton's playing list for a brief time. Peers from his uni days describe him as sharp, with a streak of ruthlessness, and a gentleman capable of being a rogue in the nicest way. According to a former flatmate, ex-St Kilda player and board director Andrew Thompson, McLaughlin will not sparkle for the dull. The only thing you don't want to be around him is boring. Early on at the AFL, McLaughlin used to skateboard to meetings, and in the office he still occasionally tries to scone someone with a stab pass of the Sharon. If the timing of various confirmation text messages to me is anything to go by, 2:33 a.m. Monday, 3:31 a.m. Wednesday, he doesn't sleep much either. "I really believe this life is playing one night only," he says. "So I say yes to everything I can socially, which means I might get there late or leave early, but I do it. I enjoy life." Ill at ease in front of a microphone, in other ways, he's happy to draw attention, whether through his sartorial choices, including a notorious mustard jacket and white newsboy cap worn to the Warrnambool races, his undiminished fondness for playing competitive polo, or the lavish Cowboys and Indians-themed 40th birthday shortly before he became CEO. The guest list included everyone from restaurateur Frank Van Handel to Magpies coach Nathan Buckley, Legal Eagle Justin Quill, and Breakfast Radio King Ross Stevenson. It was a day for Gillen to be 20 again, or 30 again. Just a fun day, says publisher Jeff Slattery, a former colleague at the AFL. He's actually happy-go-lucky, full of joie de vivre. I helped his wife Laura with her speech, and I remember the abiding theme was his sense of FOMO, fear of missing out. He's a party boy. But of course, he's also a laced-up lawyer who ended up joining blue-chip Melbourne accounting firm Arthur Anderson, now Accenture, after graduating from Melbourne University. After 2 years there, aged 27, he was recruited to the AFL in 2000 by then-boss Wayne Jackson, who was impressed not just by McLaughlin's acumen, but also his bond with footy, as a player and committee member for his local team. "It felt like a massive risk at the time," McLaughlin says of swapping billable hours for ball-up, "but I was working with a steel distributor in Mount Waverley, bored shitless, so I was vulnerable. But the AFL was very different back then. The revenue of the league was roughly 10% of what it is today." 2 years passed. Andrew Demetrio put his feet under Jackson's desk, and he wanted McLaughlin to stay. Before long, the one-time lawyer was running the revenue, managing lucrative stadium arrangements, negotiating broadcast deals, and launching the digital publishing behemoth, AFL Media. He became Demetrio's deputy in 2012, but club bosses already had the message: if you want something done, see Gill. "Shall we grab a feed?" McLaughlin asks. "We can try the pub in Birra." We head out for dinner at the Royal Mail Hotel, not the famed Dunkeld foodie destination, but the brick pub of the same name in Berrigarra, 12 kilometres down the road from McLaughlin's farm. My ute is full of crap, so we take his white Lexus SUV. We settle in the pub's front bar with the locals to watch the annual E.J. Witten Legends game, in which retired and rotund stars play a pantomime match for charity, and people mostly let him be. In the time I spend with McLaughlin, a few strangers offer a passing, "Hey Gil." But more often than not, it's he who'll turn such moments into a chat about footy, whether with a security guard, barista or publican. At the pub in Berrigarra, a kid, maybe 10, approaches to ask if McLaughlin has any footy advice. He answers as a former wiry ruckman, "There's two things you need," he tells young Isaac. "Quick hands and to practice your skills on the non-preferred side. That's all." I want to chat about the time the NRL came hard for McLaughlin in 2012. Now Sydney Morning Herald chief sports writer Andrew Webster characterised the manoeuvre as taking on the monster truck from the south. Not only would signing McLaughlin be a stunning coup, Webster wrote, it also kicked the AFL right in the cojones. Demetrio recalls the period. He'd given his deputy no guarantee he would be the next AFL boss, and so McLaughlin kept relaying the bind he felt he was in, while weeks of heavy wooing continued from the Australian Rugby League Commission's then-chairman, John Grant. Demetrio laughs about the day he demanded a decision from McLaughlin. Gil was dishevelled. His hair was everywhere. He looked out of his brain. He was pacing around my office, and I'm not speaking at all, just sitting there. He says, just say something. Say anything. Just talk. Talk. So Demetrio painted a picture. I want you to think about a Saturday afternoon driving out of Sydney to watch Penrith play Balmain, he said. And the following day, you've got to go to Townsville to watch the Gold Coast Titans against the North Queensland Cowboys. I tell this tale back to McLaughlin, who nods, smirks, then rolls his eyes. Andrew always thinks he's central to everything. McLaughlin was still unsure what answer he was going to blurt out when he walked back into Demetrio's office later that day. But I loved the game, and that's what prevailed. Meanwhile, he was also the preferred point man for handling two of the biggest controversies in the game, the Melbourne Demons tanking fiasco, in which it was alleged the club made on-field decisions that would lead to losses and better draft picks, and the Essendon supplement saga, in which the Bombers were found to have systematically injected players with a banned peptide. McLaughlin lost skin in both situations, as sanctions were handed down and clubs, careers and relationships were left in tatters. Being a regulator is one of the most difficult parts of this role, he says. You have to do it, but there's fallout. When he finally took over as boss in early 2014, those issues were still raw. Going to the footy was expensive too, so that became the new chief's raison d'etre. I just think he wanted to restore the people's faith in the game, and part of that was making the game accessible, affordable, says Richmond CEO Brendan Gale. McLaughlin persuaded stadiums to drop food and beverage costs by 40% and has held ticket prices for 5 of the past 6 years. Kids began getting in for just $5 and completely free on Sunday Funday. Routine kick-to-kick after the game returned. These aren't sexy issues, says Gale, but they're actually of great complexity and of great importance to people. Now that I think about it, the hot chips at the MCG are good value at $4.50 per salty box. But I still feel like I missed the memo. Getting cut through on such issues is, McLaughlin says, almost impossible. He hit the hustings hard, but suspects few listened. I think Gough Whitlam said, you can only say 3 things at a time, and you have to say them for 6 months before you get heard. A day earlier, we're in McLaughlin's office, adjacent to Marvel Stadium, overlooking a Docklands bathed in sunshine. Today, he wears a pastel blue sports coat, slim grey khakis, brown suede loafers and a big black Oris diving watch. When he grows wary of a topic, he holds the water bottle he's just drained against his skull and gazes into the middle distance. That's what happens when I bring up gambling. Stephen Mayne, the journalist turned shareholder activist, campaigns against the insidious creep of gambling into professional sport. The AFL is seldom out of his sights, whether due to clubs using pokies to prop up their finances or the fan experience of betting ad bombardment. The fans have made it clear they want out, but the AFL has sat mute. They have a deal with BetEasy worth $10 million a year. It's up for contract this year, and the high road would be not to renew, but apparently that's a bridge too far, says Mayne. It's the one area where he's failing to show leadership on social issues, but he's a gambler with a gambling heritage. I think that's a problem. It's true that McLaughlin loves horses and racing, which is a familial passion. His great-grandfather, Hugh Patterson McLaughlin, owned the winner of the 1931 Melbourne Cup, White Nose. He has all sorts of art on this office wall, including a Michael Lunig oil painting of a footballer. But look to the right, and there's his true love, a framed finishing post photo of Extra Zero, a gelding he owns, trained by David Hayes, which retired 2 years ago after 109 starts, winning $1.8 million in prize money. He also co-owns a horse with Tim Warner, who recently resigned as CEO of the Seven Network. That one's named Live and Free. Is his perspective on the peril of the punt inherently compromised? McLaughlin talks first about parental responsibility, with a reflection I'm not expecting. I do the quaddie on Saturday afternoons with my kids, he says. I think their maths is crap, so I take them to task on their multiplication. But I have not one fear in any way that they'll want to gamble. He also talks about fiduciary responsibility and how the money the AFL makes through its partnership with BetEasy is reinvested in community football. I do believe that when people point the finger at the AFL, they conflate the fact that we're the biggest league and have a wagering partnership with the fact that wagering has been deregulated. He believes the league's gambling advertising balance is self-regulated, pointing to limitations placed on ads at games and on TV, and keeping bookmakers off most Team Guernseys. We've been ahead of this, he says. Whether we've gone far enough is a fair debate. Debating is what McLaughlin does best, if you believe the descriptions of his leadership style. The short version is that Demetrio, his predecessor, was a force of nature, a natural-born leader who shot from the hip, while McLaughlin is a more consultative, consensus-seeking boss. I said at the start I'm different too. He's about to say Demetrio, but stops himself. I made a commitment to be more collaborative with our clubs when I took over. I believe the industry is better if we're all working together, but that's different from consensus. The Adam Goods moment is, of course, a glaring example of the downside of decision-making via consultation. Yet responding to vilification, and more importantly, making it cease, is a fiendishly tricky business. A racist February social media post about Crows forward Eddie Betts prompted some commentators to suggest ignoring the trolls, denying them the toxic oxygen they breathe. 1 month later, after AFLW star Taylor Harris endured vile sexist abuse online, the opposite was deemed the only way forward. Call it out, call it loud, and call them by name. I'm still not sure, broadly, how we can change the outcome if it happens again, ponders McLaughlin. Rugby Australia boss Raylene Castle acted decisively when she sacked top player Israel Folau in May following anti-gay comments. Castle won praise in some circles, condemnation in others, and ended up in court. Despite the cost, she arguably showed the kind of moral leadership many expect from the head of the AFL. We just got to keep learning about how we should be dealing with all these issues, is McLaughlin's summary of such situations, and how we should be leading is part of that. On gender, it's noteworthy that when McLaughlin began as CEO, there was only one woman on the 12-person executive. Now three of his 10 direct reports are women. Liz Lurkin, GM Corporate Affairs, recently stepped away for personal reasons, leaving Kylie Rogers, Sarah Fair, and Torres Strait Islander woman, Tanya Hosh. I can't understand what it's like to walk in the shoes of an Indigenous person, McLaughlin says, but Tanya will put me in that position and take me there. These appointments are changing the culture, albeit incrementally. 4 hours after Crows coach Phil Walsh was stabbed to death by his mentally unwell son in 2015, McLaughlin had a choice to make about whether it was appropriate to play football that weekend. He had to balance that instinctive male response to soldier on with the contrasting view of a number of his female staff, some of whom wanted to cancel the entire round. And we ended up in the middle, he says, because of a diversity of a people in our spectrum. They called off the Adelaide Geelong match, the first time a game had been cancelled in the history of the AFL. We didn't even cancel games in World War II. On the idea that he's a straw poll boss rather than a strong leader, McLaughlin's hackles are raised. I don't think there was any consensus about going out and supporting the yes vote on same-sex marriage, he says, noting that some clubs contradicted the AFL position. But in my gut, I knew we couldn't limp into the issue. We didn't just take a stance. We were unambiguous about our stance. There was no consensus when he stood up and launched a women's league, either, he notes. The footy world had a vague notion that a women's competition might surface around 2020. Then, in 2015, McLaughlin declared one would launch by 2017, putting it upon his stunned executive to deliver. He really went out on a limb, and I don't believe his board were too happy, says the woman known as the Footy Lady, former vice president of the Western Bulldogs, Sue Alberti. But he could see the pent-up frustration of women and the strategic potential. Yet several issues won't recede around the women's league, most notably the pay gap, the blink-and-you'll-miss-it 9-week season, and the absence, until recently, of any kind of long-term growth strategy. The truth is, good leadership gets ahead of a problem, whereas I feel like we're putting out fires and patching things up, says broadcaster Emma Race, Hawthorn's number one ticket holder and host of the ABC Radio all-female footy podcast, The Outer Sanctum. He opened the genie's bottle of women's empowerment through sport, and you can't put the lid back on. If too many baby steps is the major gripe of an impatient AFLW public, McLaughlin offers a counter. There's a history of female sporting leagues, globally, falling over, and we're determined that this is going to be sustainable. The speed of growth, expansion, is critical in that. By next year, there will be 14 AFLW clubs launched, and a 3-year plan is being thrashed out this month. The AFLW system, he points out, has to be strong, not only for a 30-year-old woman playing now, but for the 17-year-old just starting, for my 12-year-old daughter, and the girl in 20 years' time. This wasn't even an idea 5 years ago. Enter what many characterise as a spectacularly self-indulgent own goal. AFLX is a shorter format, hybrid, of the men's game, played on a rectangular field, promoted with brash bells and whistles, and, problematically, played at the pointy end of the AFLW season in a direct scheduling conflict. They talk about creating fresh air and clear space for the women's game, but one of the hurdles was their own new product, says Rice. We need funding and viewers, and instead we get silver balls and light up goalposts. AFLX, the increasing blare of pre-match entertainment, the steady transformation of the national draft into a televised spectacle, and exhibition games in China point to a gradual Americanisation of Aussie rules football, to the chagrin of some fans. McLaughlin insists there are always solid strategic reasons. We have to be relevant to a rapidly changing market, he says. If you're not appealing to new Australians, kids, millennials, Indigenous people, women, to people in Western Sydney and the Gold Coast, then you're not talking to your whole market, and you're not actually serious about growing and staying relevant and being the dominant sporting opportunity for everyone in Australia. Cheryl Critchley of the AFL Fans Association gives the CEO a big tick for fan-friendly changes like curtain-raiser matches and the annual Pride Game, but marks him down for not including a fans' representative on the AFL Competition Committee, an advisory group which meets to thrash out issues important to the code and includes presidents, CEOs, players, administrators and managers. We're the greatest single stakeholder in the game, but we've got no representation at all, she says. Shouldn't we be part of the conversation? I mention this to McLaughlin, and he reaches for the top shelf of his bookcase, brings down a bulky report, then flicks immediately to one of the many brand-track dashboards, with page upon page of line graphs, most of which seem to wiggle encouragingly upwards. Forget woke or weak, McLaughlin has a more healthy dash of wonk. You can listen to Talkback Radio and read Twitter, but you also need to know what actually is real in all that. Rather than individual opinions or those on a specific group, he says, you need quant-based research and quality-based research by market, by demographic, by hardcore supporters and broader supporters every month in every state. He goes to a lot of football too, at all levels, and people there let him know what's on their minds. I get the most passionate letters, and the moment you ring them, they say, I'm sorry, I just love my footy club. And I get that. I get that it's emotional. But I know we're going pretty well. The code's in great shape. Let's draw up a topic list. The prospect of a nighttime grand final, which gets raised because it's better for TV and therefore sponsors and advertisers. The 2018 AFL Grand Final drew an average audience of 3.38 million, beating the NRL Grand Final with 3.03 million. But many suspect that if the AFL switched its decider to a night game, it could trounce the numbers of the Northern Code. It gets raised by the media. The fans don't want it to change. It'll be an AFL commission decision. But I like a day grand final, says McLaughlin. Frequent rule changes. Yeah, on the flip side, you get a narrative about the game having too much congestion and being told, you've got to do something. The fans told us last year, through that detailed research, that their number one issue, was congestion in the game. No one likes change, full stop. So my role, my responsibility, is to make the right level of change and bring people with me. And that's not an easy balance. Mental health in football. It is clearly now the biggest issue from our playing group. It's also broader, including staff and coaches. The very visible binary nature of success and failure in our industry, and the way it's dissected every day, has a huge toll, and that's a worry for me. It's brutal, and people are breaking. The AFL recently appointed a mental health manager to work with a clinical psychiatrist to help AFL staff, clubs, players, umpires, and coaches. Concussion. I care. We care. We've invested in research for a long time, and the diagnosis and assessment we do is world class. We changed the rules to make the head sacrosanct. And remember, that wasn't popular. People railed against it. We've just got to make sure we're as progressive as we can be, and the best we can be. A team for Tasmania, a state which footy's poet laureate Martin Flanagan says has been badly let down by the AFL, to the point he's lost faith in those running the code. It's always deserved its own team, but the economics of it never added up, McLaughlin says. But we've got a plan now. Get community football growing again. Get the talent pathway producing AFL-level players. And the government have a task force looking to unify the state and make a pitch to the AFL. I'm hopeful that there will be a team in Tasmania at some point. Whatever the topic, McLaughlin's probably on a hiding to nothing. Richmond boss Brendan Gale, the man many industry insiders expect to one day take over from McLaughlin, is fond of saying that no one barracks for the AFL. There's good currency in kicking the shit out of the AFL, and sometimes as clubs we do it because it masks our own inadequacies or errors of judgment, Gale says. It really is a thankless job. I do wonder how McLaughlin copes. Back in Berrigarra, after our visit to the pub, he's sitting by his fireplace, stoking the coals as they crackle. A nice, meditative start. But his wife has said that even here, there's always a cloud of subconscious thought around him. My job is to deliver for the industry, he explains. I care about this game. And if we want to win, then I can't escape it. Because it's really important. Everyone in his team knows this. They see it made manifest too, in the way he walks the room before every AFL function, checking seating arrangements. He did it before the All-Australian night, making sure this woman was sitting next to that woman because one had flown to see the other. Success and failure is in the last 3%, not the first 97, he says. It's the extra phone call, the email, the seating arrangement, whatever. What does he do in those moments, though, when the footy public is out to get him? I compartmentalise, he says. If you don't have mechanisms and resilience and conviction to do this job, don't do it. Demetrio says legacy is an entrenched mantra at the AFL, which is where a final criticism of McLaughlin emerges. If you believe in custodianship, then you also need to plan for succession. You don't want to have this void, Demetrio says. I've said to Gill that he's almost doing himself a disservice and the AFL a disservice by not providing a succession plan. I mention this lack of a natural second in command and ask if or when he's stepping away from the job. But the thrust of the question nudges McLaughlin back into defence, his old game of shutdown. Ultimately, it's impossible to know how many more bashings he wants to endure or how many barnacles he wants clinging to his resume. But right now, there's still work to be done. The current broadcast deal ends in 2022, and the next one will probably need to be signed next year. It'd be much more complex, too, as internet giants like Google, Amazon and Facebook show an interest in streaming sporting leagues around the world, and local free-to-air and cable TV stations attempt to become platform agnostic. Timeline aside, is there another public-facing role in his future? Another sporting body in need of a skipper? What interests him? Sincerely, I don't know, he says, shrugging. I like leading teams. I like working with people. I'm enjoying the role, he says, pausing. He stays silent for a long time, then smiles. I've gone back into my shell, haven't I?
If you're enjoying this podcast, please remember to subscribe so you don't miss future episodes. And remember to rate and comment on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. The newsrooms of The Age and the Sydney Morning Herald are all working remotely during the coronavirus pandemic. So this episode has been recorded from our homes, and the sound quality isn't the best. But rest assured, we'll be back in the studio as soon as we can.
Hello, my name's Katrina Strickland, and I'm the editor of Good Weekend. Here with me today to talk about the AFL Chief Executive, Gillon McLaughlin, we have Conrad Marshall, Senior Writer with Good Weekend, and Michael Gleeson, Senior Sports Writer with The Age. Welcome, Conrad and Michael.
Hey, guys.
Hey, thanks for having us.
Michael, let's cut to the chase. Gillon McLaughlin originally insisted that the AFL could play on during the coronavirus. About 6 days later, he made a decision to stop the competition altogether. What do you think that change of mind says about his leadership style, and what was it based on?
Well, first of all, it wasn't Gill's decision alone. It was an AFL commission decision. He obviously had his own personal opinion, and the executive had their opinion, which informed the commission's view. They were trying to show leadership in both senses. They were aware of their social standing, the cultural hold that football has in the community, and that informed the first decision, which was strongly encouraged by the federal government, that they should seek to play on, that it wasn't against medical or health advice to play on, and that they sought to do so. Bear in mind, there was a very significant financial component to this as well, that they wanted to get games played and their competition up and running, that they sought to play without a crowd. Now, that was obviously going to mean an enormous financial hit. But once games got going, it just felt wrong. And I think that they recognised that as well. The commission recognised that. With football going on, it sent a mixed message to the community that when you're complaining about sunbathers on Bondi Beach, you can't turn around and criticise them and then turn around and applaud a goal being kicked in a game of footy.
Conrad, you wrote in your Good Weekend profile on Gillon McLachlan that he has a very consultative and collaborative style, perhaps much more so than his predecessor, Andrew Demetrio. Was this indicative of that?
Well, I think it certainly suited this moment. You know, being collaborative and consultative was probably the only path that you can take here, and probably served him well. There are so many stakeholders to manage in a situation like this, whether it's sort of clubs as entities as a whole, players, coaches, the stadiums. But there also must have been so much advice to heed from the government, from the chief medical officer. Also, when we're talking about that change in direction, the decision to play round one and then to change tack a few days later, people would naturally feel like criticising someone for a backflip, when really it's just a case of him being given, or them being given, more information. We knew a lot more about the evolving situation at the end of round one than we did at the start of round one. So
it is an interesting one, because he also wrestled in that piece about the idea that social issues are the hardest ones to make. I think he's comfortable with the fiscal decisions, but the social ones, and this was both. This was everything. And on top of that, he's looking at this coronavirus situation is, you know, unquestionably an existential threat to the game. You know, the game itself will be radically different to survive, because the money has disappeared from the game this year. So it is a really difficult period for him to negotiate, wanting to be seen as a social and a community leader, but then realising, you know what, the bigger social good here is for us not to play. But that's rubbing up against the idea of the fiscal responsibility he has to the game to try and keep it alive.
Yeah, that's true. He's also juggling, I guess, the difference between being a kind of a peacetime leader and a wartime leader. You know, he's Eric Schmidt and Larry Page. He's Robert Menzies and John Curtin. So he's presided over this period of sort of expansion and wealth, and now he has to focus on, as you said, an existential threat to the game.
Well, he's also, and you might have got a better sense of this, there's been the speculation over his own future in the game. How long is he going to stay in this role? And now he's confronting this thing which would be exhausting to anyone. Now, he probably, a bit like Demetrio staying on longer when the Essendon scandal and the drugs thing was going on, there was a need for him and to not have that succession at that point. You know, if there wasn't an end coming for Gill, this will be the period that he has to last through. He has to carry the game through.
It feels that way. It feels like, even in talking about putting this piece together, we spoke about it as a potential sort of, or they spoke about it as a legacy piece for him. And you got this sense that he wanted to wrestle with the next broadcast rights agreement and then saunter off into some other role. But I think he needs to remain at the helm, and probably will see it as his duty to. They talk all the time inside AFL HQ about legacy, about leaving the game in better shape than you found it. He'll probably feel now his raison d'etre is to maintain order throughout this period, and then, you know, sort of restore security after that before he leaves. So And who knows how long that could take? Like, it really could extend his tenure by, you know, a couple of years.
And the piece that you wrote, Conrad, and there was a quote that jumped out at me when I was rereading it, and the quote was, "It's been a really good year for footy, a great year." Well, how does he feel about that right now? Because this could not be, the football's never endured a worse time. And in fact, you know, as we speak this week, it's the worst week in sport Australia has ever witnessed. We've got rugby league has shut down, AFL football shut down, soccer has shut down, the Olympics have been postponed. There is no sport.
I can't imagine a bigger sort of shift in the space of 6 months, really. That was something he said, I guess, coming into awards season last year when the AFL was looking so strong, and it's just so different right now. I think one of the people I spoke to for the story mentioned how the AFL is like the Vatican on the Yarra. I know that's a quote that Katrina's really fond of. And I feel like the exodus in staff across the league hasn't just been in clubland. It must have been at Liege HQ as well. So in there right now, it's probably less of a congregation of cardinals and more like an empty cathedral.
Michael, the AFL has much better financial standing, doesn't it, than the NRL, which everyone, including NRL boss Peter Vlanders himself, is talking about not being in great shape. Why is the AFL in a better position, and how much of that can be sheeted home to Gillen's job?
Well, I wouldn't sheet it home to Gillen, but I'd sheet it home to the AFL overall. Since they became a commission where power was sort of removed from the hands of the vested interested club presidents, into the more centralised body. They were probably a bit more corporate and progressive in that way.
Jake, I think, was also talking just recently about the kind of the billion-dollar asset that the AFL has that the NRL doesn't in Marvel Stadium, and that sort of shrewd purchase that was made over the last decade or so.
Yeah, that's what's basically helping them survive at the moment. They did have a fair bit in cash, but they were able to buy out that a bit early with Future Fund money. Through the more recent broadcast deals, they did carve off some amount into a Future Fund. And it's basically in the last 3 years, it's been $20 million a year into a Future Fund. So it's got 60 sitting in there at the moment. And that's after they've paid out for Marvel. So at the moment, they're scrabbling around with the banks to try and get line of credit, up to $500 million worth of credit to keep the competition alive. And that's all based on the fact that they now own this stadium, which is absolutely underpinning the competition.
If we can just go to Gillen, right back to the idea of profiling him, Conrad, what made you want to do that? I mean, he'd been in the job for 5 years last year when you started talking about it. What was it that made you think he would be a good profile?
Well, first of all, just the notion that he'd never been profiled. I mean, people had written about him and skirted around the edges, but he'd never agreed to sort of sit down for one of those very long-form kind of interviews. I think the largest that he ever did was a little spread in Women's Weekly at the kind of the start of his tenure. Felt like he was one of those characters in Australian society who's widely seen but still sort of unknown.
And Michael, are you surprised that he has been able until now not to do the kind of big sit-down interview and kind of profile? Obviously, he's not that keen on it, but normally in those positions, you really don't have that much choice. But he's kind of got away with it for 5 years, hadn't he, in a way?
Yes and no. Partly, his predecessor, Andrew, was probably a bit better known because he was Andy Demetriou, the guy with the moustache that played for Kangaroos and Hawthorn. Gill was a bit unknown. He was just a very tall bloke who came from Adelaide and played polo. He's an interesting one because you're always just compared to your predecessor, and he was obviously worked under Andrew. Gill, to me, is always the consensus to hesitate and then get a consensus and then respond. And that hesitation often leads to the appearance of indecision and weakness, and that's not necessarily an accurate position, but it is the perception that it gives, and I think of the Adam Goods thing in particular with that.
Conrad, what's your take on that?
Yeah, I mean, look, he is certainly aware of that perception of him, and And it can raise his hackles. You know, it gets his back up a little bit. You tell him he's a consensus leader and he says, well, you know, I don't remember any consensus about AFLW when I, you know, decided to stand up and bring that decision forward by 2 years. And there was marriage equality stood up and decided to replace the AFL logo temporarily with yes in support of that campaign, which he didn't have to do as well. So there are other examples.
One of the bad decisions that he made was going right back to the Essendon case when he decided not to pursue Dr. Bruce Reid, because he felt at that point, not without justification, that there was that they were clear of it, that they got the people they needed, and they didn't need to take down anymore, and they needed clear air. They underestimated the degree to which that would gain traction, and that it would continue to go on, and that some of the time there's a fight that you've just got to be prepared to have. And it fed the idea, which I think Gill has learnt from then, and I think he learned from that, to realise some of the time you have to have a fight, and some of the time you do have to stand for something rather than just look for clear air and the optics. Some of the time you've got to be prepared to have a fight.
And he learnt that also from the Goods experience, didn't he, Conrad? I think he basically said he would have handled it differently with hindsight.
If he had his time over, he would handle that completely differently. And again, I think that's one of those decisions where he consulted widely. It's the consensus leadership model. He was probably listening to some presidents who believed that it wasn't racist. He may have even heard such murmurings from people on the commission and decided to factor in all those views and not call it out strongly enough. And he absolutely regrets that moment, but you don't get it back. You know, he can apologise all he wants.
And Michael, what is the fans' view of Gillen generally, or do they not think of him? Is he, as you say, administrators are not really something that people think about. It's all about the players.
I'm not sure there is a universal view of Gill, because I think he confounds people a bit, because they assume to think that he is the silver spoon guy from the rich school and the polo playing, and then he's actually earthier than that, and so they can't quite get a handle on which pigeonhole they should put him in.
And Conrad, how did you find him in that respect? How easy was he to open up, and what surprised you about him?
Look, it was very hard to open up at the beginning in the sense of trying to get permission to profile him. It was probably one of the hardest negotiations I've had in getting access to someone. I had to get people who I knew that were close to him to personally vouch for me. I certainly, after I'd met him, it was clear that he'd read a number of my stories, so wanted to kind of look at how he might be portrayed. Had to have sort of off the record chats about where we wanted to go until he felt comfortable and established that sense of trust. And I don't know, even then throughout the process, I felt like there was this common sort of constant search for common ground. Like, I knew he had his farm in Birragara. I have a tiny little cottage about 20 minutes away in Winchelsea, so I sort of suggested maybe we could catch up for a chat out that way and get to talking about the Western districts outside Melbourne. I don't know, I tried every trick in the book. You know, I knew he was a ruckman, so I started chatting about how I was a ruckman in amateurs and we may have even played against one another. But I found him good, as Michael said, really good company, and getting out to the farm and seeing him in those surrounds, you know, wearing his dirty Blundstones and faded jeans and kind of stoking the coals of an open fire there with a cheap beer. He was much more earthy than that very tall man in a pinstripe double-breasted suit that you see on TV.
Hang on, you said he was drinking Stella's in the story. That's not that cheap.
$40 a slab these days, mate.
At least they weren't clean-skinned wines. Well, Conrad, you said that that Gill read your stuff beforehand before agreeing to it. I assume he read it afterwards. What did he think? Have you any feedback?
Yeah, he enjoyed it. You know, it's always difficult sort of getting the response from a person. If he enjoyed the story, does that mean that I failed as a hard-hitting journalist? But he sent me a nice little photo, actually, of his daughter sitting up in bed reading it with a little thumbs up. And then he ends his text message the way he always does, with his curious little sign-off, bang, bang. Is the way he ends every text.
What's that mean?
I don't know. Good work.
Are you still in contact, Conrad?
Yeah, absolutely. He reads a story of mine occasionally and will send a little thumbs up, bang, bang, or just say well done or good job on something, and I'll do the same. I texted him a couple of days ago just to see how he was holding up throughout COVID-19 and haven't heard back. So I guess he's quite busy. That's understandable, but I'm sure I'll hear back again soon.
Michael, what's his legacy going to be?
Well, a lot will... Previously, I would have just said AFLW. Now, I would say the survival of the game. What happens in the next 12 months will be as important to informing the legacy of Gill than anything in the last 6 years.
And how much of it, when you talk about survival of the game, a lot of that is out of his hands and the commission's hands, isn't it? Because it depends how long the shutdown, the economic shutdown goes on for.
So many decisions to make. I am just glad that I'm not the one that has to make them. And I'm kind of glad that someone like Gillon McLachlan is the one who has to make them. He said, and I think I might have put it into the story, that he doesn't think success is in the first 97% of what you do, that it's in the last 3%. So he's this person who has sort of immense attention to detail, does not sleep more than about 4 hours a night. I heard somebody report that during the week, as if it was something that was happening with coronavirus unfolding, but that's just his reality. He's one of those people. Gleeso, I was wondering, who do you think his natural sort of successor would be?
Well, I think they're all running for the hills at the moment. I think the job...
Yeah, who wants the job?
Yeah, I think the job that was one of the most coveted in Australian sport is one of the least enviable of all right now. So I think it really would change. If you're a Brendan Gale, you're sitting there thinking, yeah, do I really actually want to take on that job?
And in any case, I guess no one's going anywhere until all of this is over and we emerge out the other side. That's probably a good note to finish on. Thank you, Michael and Conrad, for a really interesting conversation.
No worries.
Cheers.
Wash your hands.
Subscriptions power our writers. To support independent journalism, search Subscribe Sydney Morning Herald or The Age. This episode of Good Weekend Talks was produced and edited by Anu Hasbold, with editorial assistance by Conrad Marshall. Technical assistance by Cormac Lally, with casting by Catapult. Tom McKendrick is head of audio, and Katrina Strickland is the editor of Good Weekend. I'm Conrad Marshall. Thanks for listening.